Where warp meets weft.
Where warp meets weft.
This is Weavecast with Sign Mitchell.
Hello, and welcome to Episode 3, Weaving Metal. We've got a lot going on this episode. Today's topic is weaving with wire and flat pieces of metal. And with us is jeweler and reluctant weaver Arlene Fish. I'll describe a swatch woven out of wire, and then we'll have today's audio essay, Weaving Metal. Welcome back. It's good to be back at the microphone after almost a month. I'd like to welcome all the new Weavecast Guild members. I have gotten a lot of new entries in the Frapper map, and I'm just delighted. It is great to see everybody's faces on the map, and some people have been posting their work, which is a double treat because I love looking at beautifully woven things. Big thanks for all the people who took the time to go do that. And I've got a little treat for our virtual guild members. Krista Giles, a talented graphical artist, among many, many other things. I went to her website doing due diligence before I started this episode, and the lady is amazing. She does glass beads, she does adult-sized hula hoops, all kinds of wonderful stuff. So you should go check out her website. I'll have a link in the show notes. But the amazing Krista Giles created our very own Weavecast button. So if you have a blog or a website and you'd like to declare your Weavecast alliance, please download this button and feel free to make use of it. And it would be lovely if you linked back to the site and helped spread the word about Weavecast. People who also listen to Cast On will notice it's very similar to the I Knit and I Spin buttons from the Cast On site, and that's because Krista Giles also did the artwork for those. And I was so delighted with those buttons and so happily jealous that I begged Brenda Dane to give me Krista's email, and things happily progressed from there. So please do go up to the blog and take a look at the new button. It's very cute. She did a wonderful job. Thank you, Krista. I've got a shearing update. The sheep are shorn. Some things really are best learned in a hands-on class. This past weekend, I went to the Shepherd's Extravaganza in Puyallup, and there was a wonderful instructress, Susie Wilson. She showed me a different way to shear. I had been trying the official New Zealand, you know, throw the sheep on the ground and roll it around like little pillbug method, which has an amazingly steep learning curve. And she said, well, you put your sheep in a halter and you tie them to the barn and let them stand up. And boy, that's a lot easier. And the sheep really appreciate this new technique. So thank you, Sage instructors. I also have a clarification because I know that some people who listen to Weavecast also listen to Cast On and may have heard the spot I did on that podcast, in which I talk about my upcoming surgery. And I just want to reassure people that the surgery won't happen until next year. I had my surgical consult this week, and it is a go. He says, I really do need it. Darn it. So there's a year's worth of orthodontics between now and then. And rest assured, Weavecast will go on. I've already got a guest host lined up for my timeout period next year, and we'll just keep you apprised on how that's going. And there was a listener of Cast On who sent me an email. She had been through the exact same surgery, and I am so grateful because she contacted me, she told me about her experiences, and it allayed some of my fears, and it was a very wonderfully generous thing of her to do. I'm not going to mention her name because I haven't asked permission, but you know who you are. And I hope you're listening, and thank you. Today's swatch was, well, it's only half completed, but it was woven in a class. I took a class on weaving with wire at the 2004 Convergence, which was held in Tacoma. The instructor was Donna Kaplan. This instructress was very ingenious. She made us all these wonderful little looms. And I'm going to describe it briefly and then describe the swatch, because the loom is really interesting and fascinating too. And if you wanted to get started weaving, you could make this loom and weave little tiny things for not so much money. And you don't have to weave wire on it. You could weave pretty much anything. So the way this loom is put together are there are two dowels, little short dowels about 6 inches long. And each dowel has two holes drilled through it, about half an inch from the end. Threaded between these dowels is some threaded rod, and then locking nuts have been used to space out the dowels on the ends of these two threaded rods. So the threaded rods are running vertically, the dowels are going horizontally, and the whole thing is making a rectangular frame that's about 11 inches long and 6 inches wide. Now, the warp is wound around the top, threaded through a plastic rigid heddle, and then wound around the bottom and then secured back up at the top. And I'll have a picture of this on the website. So please do go to the blog at www.weavecast.com and you'll see a picture of what I'm talking about. The rigid heddle, like all rigid heddles, has slots and holes, and half of the wires are woven through the holes and half of them are woven through the slots. So if you push down, you get one shed, and if you pull up, you get another shed. And then a rubber band has been used to attach the rigid heddle to the threaded rods on the side. Actually, three rubber bands. And I believe that's just to keep the rigid heddle from flopping around too much. And then I also have a little popsicle stick at the bottom holding everything spaced out nicely, kind of acting like a little tiny, tiny rattle. The wire that we've used is very thin gauge copper. And originally, magnet wire was what weavers used to use when they wove with wire, because it was very thin, inexpensive, readily available, but few colors. When I was in the physics department, I actually snagged a spare spool of magnet wire that they were throwing out, and I still have it, and it's orange. But these days, wire manufacturers have clued into the fact that fiber and jewelry and beading enthusiasts will pay good money for interesting colors. So there are a lot more colors available these days. What I've done is I have woven a weft-faced fabric using a black super thin wire against a copper-colored wire. I wove it weft-faced because I started to weave it a more balanced weave, and the fabric that came out of that was just not very interesting. It was very loose and flabby, and so I, in frustration, packed it tighter. And when I packed it tighter, I liked it better. It looks like basket weave, kind of, and it's more structurally sound. I've warped 12 warp threads going up and down, and the whole thing is about an inch wide. The heddle is a 12-inch branch. Yep, it says right there, shot, rigid heddle, 12-inch branch. But I packed it down tight, and it made this really nice fabric, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to weave for a bracelet, and then when I take it off, if I want to, I can bend and crenellate the fabric, and it'll stay in that shape, and I can make a really interesting shape. And the instructress had this really cool technique where she would bend the ends over and kind of make a clasp out of the fabric itself. After I had woven a little bit with just the plain black wire, I strung together some glittery, must have mylar in it, thread with a wire and packed that down. So I have some horizontal stripes between black and this glittery red. It's really quite interesting. And I need to finish this project. This would be a fun bracelet to make. And you could make earrings out of this. You can make necklaces out of this. The instructress she just made these really amazing collar style necklaces where she took woven strips of this material and then folded it. And because it was metal, it stayed folded. So she was able to shape it into the shape of a collar and then pleat it. And it just made really beautiful things. But that's today's swatch. Next up, we have an interview with Arlene Fish, who does some really amazing things with metal and textile techniques. And I was talking to her, and she said, oh, I'm not a weaver. And I think she would consider herself a jeweler. But because she learned textile techniques, she couldn't help playing with them. And if you listen to the interview, you'll see what I mean. I think she was doomed to be a weaver, despite her own protestations. But her work is gorgeous, and I will have some links to galleries that host her work so you can go and look at it. Imagine incredibly lacy things knit out of sterling silver. Imagine gloves that stand up by themselves and are posable because they've been knit out of wire. Imagine brooches woven out of sterling silver where some of it has been oxidized black and some of it is still silver. Imagine twill woven, tiny, tiny little strips of metal. Just gorgeous stuff. Cuffs and collars and drapeable squares. It beggars my powers of description. So I'll try to find some good visuals you can go check out on the website. I must warn you that it was challenging finding a time when Arlene could be interviewed because her schedule was very busy, but she graciously carved out a slice for us. And we drove around for a while and settled in a cafe. And the cafe has some background noise. Because I knew that this would be an ad hoc, off-the-cuff interview, I brought my micro-mini recording studio with me, which consists of an AKG C1000S microphone attached to an iRiver, which is pretty hilarious because it's a big honking microphone. Thick cable attached to the digital recorder, which is about the size of a pack of gum. Oh, it was so funny. Please help me welcome Arlene Fish. Well, hello. This is Sign Mitchell of Weavecast. We are on location in Seattle in a coffee shop. So if you hear some unusual background noise, that's what's going on. With me is Arlene Fish, who I was talking to her earlier. She said she's not a weaver, but she does amazing work using metals with textile techniques. So we're very lucky to have her with us today. And she's just completed a presentation to the Seattle Weavers Guild, and we were very lucky in that she agreed to come talk to us here today. My first question is, what made you want to combine metal and textile techniques?
Well, the fact that I knew both technologies helped. I was curious about it when I saw a few examples of ancient Peruvian textiles that used metal in unusual ways. And so I tried a few things right immediately after I saw those examples. And then I didn't do anything for a long time because I was involved in other things, more metal-oriented things. And the next time it came time to do that was when I was on a freighter in the Mediterranean for 5 days and had nothing to do because I hadn't planned to be on that freighter. And so I asked the captain if they had any wire. And sure enough, they had wonderful copper wire in quite small dimensions. And he gave me a big coil of it. And I sat on the deck and played with that wire, just doing simple, mostly net type things. And when I got back to home base in Copenhagen, I actually made a piece based on what I had done on the ship. But again, I didn't pursue that very far until several years later when I was more seriously interested in trying some weaving, which I hadn't actually done, but I thought could be done. And I made a few pieces. And it was pretty interesting what some things that I supposed would be necessary weren't necessary, and some things that I thought would be easy weren't so easy. I made a few pieces, and at the same time I thought, well, I could probably try some other things that I know how to do, which were knitting, basically knitting. I knew how to do that. And so I did actually knit, spool knit a piece at the same time that I was doing the weaving. And again, there was a hiatus when I didn't do anything for a year or two, until I was approached by a publisher in New York about would I be interested in doing a jewelry book. And I said, no, I wouldn't be, because I'm not particularly technically oriented. That didn't interest me. But I thought about it, and I thought, you know, this textile structure, it has a lot of possibilities, and nobody's talking about that. There's no information. I knew that because I'd been looking, and I hadn't found anything. I proposed to the publisher, if they were interested in that subject, that I would do a dry run in Australia. I was going on a lecture tour in Australia, and I would do a workshop or two, and I would lecture about this, and I would sort of gauge the response and see whether I thought other people found this interesting. And if they did, then I would send him an outline. And that's what happened. The people in Australia were interested.
What was the title of that book?
It's called Textile Techniques in Metal. And I took a year and explored all of the things that I knew about and some things that I didn't know about that I had to learn just to see whether they would work in metal. And everything does.
Did you find that you had to make accommodations to the metal because it's so different than the flexibility of fiber?
Tension is the biggest thing. You have to do everything a lot looser than you would do it in yarn because metal has no elasticity. It doesn't stretch. And so you just have to learn to handle your tools in a slightly different way so that the structure is a little more open. You also have to not be a perfectionist because it isn't perfect. And I learned that that was hard for metals people, that an edge of a piece of weaving is not a true straight edge. And for people who are used to filing an edge to make it perfect, this is unacceptable. So I just tell those people not to do it because if it makes them unhappy, there's no point. Weavers find it less problematic because they're used to not having edges that they have to file or true up quite as strenuously as a metals person.
I know you taught at San Diego. When you were teaching there, were you a jewelry instructor? Because I take it you weren't a textile instructor.
Actually, I started when I was teaching at Skidmore, and I came as a jeweler. I had already been studying in Denmark, and jewelry was what I wanted to do. But there was a jewelry professor on the faculty at Skidmore. Had a large art faculty, but only one in each area. And so it was clear I wasn't ever going to teach metal. I was hired to teach art education. When the weaving instructor retired, she said to me, "Why don't you take over the weaving program, and that will be yours?" And so I said, "That's great, but I don't know how to weave." And she said, "That's all right, we'll send you to school." So Skidmore actually sent me to Haystack for 6 weeks, and my first teacher was Jack Larson. My second teacher was a fairly prominent weaver named Ted Hallman. And then I went back to Skidmore and I taught weaving for a year. At the end of that time, a job announcement came across my path to start a jewelry program at San Diego State. And since that was what I really wanted to do, I applied for that job and was hired. When I arrived at San Diego State, I did come with the intention of starting a jewelry program, but at the same time, there were two looms sitting in the room that I was assigned, and
weaving was following you around.
I happened to mention to the students that I knew how to do that. At the time, weaving was taught in the home economics department, and the art students wouldn't go near it. So I gradually started this weaving program. I begged, borrowed, and collected looms from weaving guilds in San Diego, and pretty soon we had a room full of looms. It was a very heady time for textiles, especially in Southern California in the early 60s. There were huge exhibitions of large-scale textile things because people like Magdalena Bakanovich was working with very large rope structures, and all through the early 60s, there were lots of people doing really exciting things in textiles. So for me, it was a very exciting time to be involved with textiles. I never considered myself a weaver. I never showed any weaving. I did weaving because I wanted to teach the students, but I never showed any professionally because I didn't think of myself as a textile person. teaching weaving was like having a research group. It was wonderful because I was observing and learning about all these interesting pre-Columbian textiles and seeing what people in Europe were doing with them. And I could simply pass that information directly to the students and say, here, try this, because I wasn't going to. And so it was like, you know, it was wonderful. We had a very nice, very active textile program, but a fairly non-traditional one.
I think that's great. I'm really glad that you took that sidelong path and learned weaving, because the work that you showed in the slides today was just amazing. If you have a chance to look at Arlene Fish's books, you really should. Really beautiful stuff. And she has a new one that's coming out this next week called Crocheted Wire Jewelry by Lark Books. And I imagine that's going to be just wonderful. I haven't got a chance to look at it yet, but you should really check it out. What's interesting to me is that she makes these creations using relatively simple looms. So I was wondering, would you talk about the kind of equipment that you use?
I'm really a very low-tech kind of person. When I weave, I use a 4-harness or an 8-harness loom. I used to use a floor loom, but it takes up too much space. So because I'm doing very narrow things for the most part, I use a table loom. My favorite one is a Structo table loom, which is a metal loom, but they're very hard to find, and actually any table loom will work just as well. I use knitting machines. I have a portable Brother single bed machine, which does very simple things. I have a Passep double bed machine, which does tubular material, but it's a little harder to work with, but does wonderful pattern stuff. Textured patterns, not color patterns. I tend not to do that very much, but the machine will do that if I ask it to. But my favorite machine is a sock knitting machine because it's the simplest to use. It makes tubular material in 2 sizes. The size of the cylinder when all the needles are engaged, and then a smaller size when I take out half of the needles. And I can alter the size of the stitch somewhat. I tend to knit very open structures because I like to be able to manipulate them, and if they're too tight, you can't do that. That's basically the only real equipment I use. If I'm braiding, I use a vise and a wooden mandrel that I've made to braid over. Most of the time, I work on a table.
A couple of the pieces that you showed today were really intriguing in that you had brightly colored feathers. You put the shaft of the feather into little tubes and worked that into woven designs. Where did that inspiration come from?
Probably 2 places. Pre-Columbian textiles use a lot of feathers, and they are incredibly well preserved, which is very interesting because feathers that are 1,500 years old haven't faded, and they haven't been damaged as long as moths haven't gotten to them. And I thought that was kind of interesting. So I thought about using feathers because it gave me an opportunity to use color. I had a friend who had tropical birds, and so he gave me bags of feathers. It turns out you can't buy those, but you can buy other kinds of feathers. And I found feathers a wonderfully seductive material. They're soft and sensuous. And so I found a company called Hollywood Fancy Feathers that sells feathers for the costume industry. And they sell fabulous domesticated bird feathers. And so I bought lots of those. And for a while I made a number of pieces I tend not to use them much anymore.
Well, in the pieces that I saw, it was really intriguing because you have something as organic and light as a feather mixed with the hard material inflexibility of metal. It was very, very cool. If you're not using feathers these days, what are you working on currently? What's getting you inspired?
Well, I do love to use color, and initially the feathers provided that. And then for a while I worked with anodized aluminum, again, because there's a whole palette of colors that I can make. But in the textile structures, I now use a lot of coated copper wire, which is now readily available in lots of different colors. Initially, it was an industrial material that I found in salvage yard, and it came in a fairly limited range of colors. Now there's somebody who's producing it for the craft industry, and the colors have increased enormously. So I use that quite a lot. It knits and it crochets very easily.
Another interesting material that you were talking about is titanium, which I've done some anodizing, and I know titanium anodizes as well. Isn't it a little bit brittle to work with? Do you ever have to worry about over-manipulating the metals when you're working with them?
You do, and there are some things I don't do with titanium. When I used it, it was in weaving as a weft so that it didn't actually have to ever bend. It just went straight across the warp, and it was a discontinuous weft because the titanium material that I used came from the aircraft industry, and it was very thin, like 2/1000ths, and very sharp on the edges, so you had to be careful. But if you bent it once, it cracked, and so I had to think of ways to not do that. There are other titanium alloys that are available that would be easier to work with, but I'm not so interested in doing that anymore, so I haven't explored that. There's another metal called niobium, which is related to titanium, which is much friendlier. It is softer, more, and it works more like sterling silver, but it's also heavier. The problem with the color for me is that it has a very specific color range. You get specific colors at specific voltages. And I find the colors very sweet. They're not something I want to use a lot.
What advice would you give fiber artists who were interested in working with metal? What would be a good jumping off place?
Because you're working with metal that's, one, quite soft. Copper is a very soft metal. And silver, fine silver is a very soft metal. It's not difficult to manipulate. And also you're working with very small gauges. I don't recommend ever working with anything even as big as 0.5 millimeter. Encourage people to think about using very thin wire in multiples for things like knitting and crocheting. Where they want more bulk, just use 3 or 4 or 5 strands together in order to achieve that bulk. It's much easier on your hands. Putting a metal warp on a loom is no different from putting any other kind of warp on a loom, except that you probably need more help because you don't want the wires to kink. But that's really the only difference. I pad the front and back beam of the loom so that the wire doesn't cut the wood, but that's really the only alteration I do on the loom. I used to use only string heddles, but I found that wire heddles work also. It's the flat metal heddles that don't, because they tend to be a little too abrasive on the wire.
I wondered about how careful you have to be to make sure that you're not marring the metal as you're working it. It seems like that would be a big concern. I hadn't even thought about potentially cutting your wood loom up. If you're interested in checking out more about Arlene Fish and her amazing work, Elegant Fantasy, The Jewelry of Arlene Fish, published by Arnalsha. Then there is Textile Techniques in Metal, which was published by Lark Books. And the forthcoming Crocheted Wire Jewelry by Lark Books. There's also about an hour-long interview with Arlene on the Smithsonian Archives of American Art, their craft documentation project. And I'll have links to all of these on the show notes. So thank you very much, Arlene.
I already know how you feel.
Today's audio essay is Weaving Metal, and it's a bit of a pun because this was a day that tested my mettle. It was one of those days where really good things happened and really bad things happened, and you just never knew which way things were going to go next. I went to my guild meeting today, which is a wonderful thing. I love my guild meetings. They bring me together with about 200 other weavers, and we just have a fabulous time, and it's great feeling that enthusiasm for the craft. And I got to see my COE buddy. For those of you not in the know, COE stands for Certificate of Excellence, and I am working towards my hand weaving Certificate of Excellence with the encouragement and inspiration of a COE buddy named Kate. She is a woman on fire. If I don't get my COE, I'll be disappointed. If she doesn't get her COE, I'm going to be knocking on some doors and finding out why. Because the woman is a fabulous weaver. She is so delightful that you can't even hate her for being a fabulous weaver. And best of all, she sees fit to encourage me and pester me when I don't show up with the samples I'm supposed to. So thank you, Kate. I really appreciate the kick in the butt from time to time. So I got to see Kate, and today was Lad Lama sale, so I showed up with a whole van full of weaving supplies to sell. And I'm sitting, listening to the guild business being presented on the stage. Some of you may or may not know, I put WeaveCast in for a grant. My guild offers an annual grant to promote hand weaving and inspire people to look into hand weaving and to help the craft and the guild get publicity. While I was sitting there, the grant coordinator came up and she wasn't supposed to announce the winner until the end of May. But she said, our judge came back with the results early. And so that was very exciting. And I was scared and filled with anticipation as I sat there, totally stunned, completely unexpected that this would be announced today. And I sat there riveted, and I watched, and I listened, and she said someone else's name. And I had been, you know, psyching myself up to be a really good loser in May. I really wanted to be the kind of loser who, you know, jumps up and hugs the winner and offers them heartfelt congratulations. But she kind of caught me unawares, and I wasn't expecting it. It was a blow. I was surprised at how much of a blow it was. As a writer, I get rejected pretty regularly and I'm fairly inured to it. And the funny thing was, it wasn't the money. I mean, the money would have been nice. I would have welcomed help with the server hosting costs, and it would have been great to get some help with the gasoline costs from driving around doing all these interviews. And I had my eye on some audio editing software, but it wasn't the money. It was the loss of validation. When I applied for that grant, it made doing WeaveCast more than just me sitting at my microphone. It was a mission. It was, I'm going to promote hand weaving and better the guild and do great things. What it felt like when the winner was announced and it wasn't me was, you have been judged not worthy, and the work you're doing isn't good enough. That hurt. And unfortunately, I am cursed with a pale Irish complexion, so for me, there is no hiding behind a stiff upper lip. When I am upset, my nose turns red and my eyes turn red, and no amount of stoicism is just going to fool anybody. So after people started to kind of look nervously in my direction, I got up and went for a walk outside. Our guild meets in the basement of a church. And wouldn't you know it, right outside, the church was hosting Tent City, which is an initiative that helps homeless by giving them a safe place to camp out while they're trying to get their act together. So it was like, I can't even feel sorry for myself because I was faced with people who have it so much worse than me. It really instantly put things into perspective. It's like you're upset because you didn't win a grant, and here are people who have lost everything. It was one of those you gotta laugh or you gotta cry moments, and I think I kind of did both. But I walked around and contemplated life, and there was a moment where I was really down in the dumps and I was thinking about just chucking it all in, because public speaking does not come easily to me. I'm not the kind of person who can just sit down, record it, save it, publish it. It takes me a couple of takes, and there's a lot of audio editing involved. So I spend a good solid week doing each episode, between planning the interview, doing the interview, writing up show notes, finding my swatch of the day in my stash. It's a lot of work. Then I started to remember all the wonderful comments that I've gotten. And I thought about the people who said, I'm a new weaver and I'm so glad that there's a place I can go and get some information about weaving. And I thought about the people who said, I don't have a local guild and it's great to have a place where I can hear somebody talking about weaving. And I remembered the knitters who'd said, I've never done weaving, but I listened to your podcast and I want to try. You've inspired me. I want to thank everyone who's ever written a comment or put their pin on a Frapper map or sent me an email or given me any encouragement. I really appreciate it. A lot more fun to have a two-way conversation. I get a lot out of doing the podcast. I like playing with the audio geek toys. I love interviewing wonderful weavers. I have not yet had a weaver turn down my request for an interview. These women are fonts of knowledge and experience and very generous with their time. So I'd like to thank everyone who's given me an interview. So I'm going to ask your help with something. First of all, it's been kind of a rough day for your podcaster here. If you can spare the 30 seconds or so it would take to go up to www.weavecast.com and post a comment, you know, you go girl would be sufficient. Or just, you know, hey, I find your podcast worthwhile and I'm listening. That would really cheer me up. And while you're spreading the wealth, feel free to drop in on other podcasts that mean something to you. As soon as I get this audio polished and this thing popped up there, that's what I'm going to do. In addition, it would be wonderful if you helped get the word out, because the best advertisement is word of mouth. If you like Weavecast, please encourage other weaver friends or other knitter friends or other people you think might enjoy the show to have a listen. Let me offer this up to you. I'm telling you my sad little story of disappointment and self-doubt and resolve for this reason. Everyone runs up against failure. It might be a warp that just breaks and will not stay on the loom. It might be the beautiful shawl that you threw in the washer and dryer and turned into a wrinkled rag. Don't let failure stop you from doing what you love. Learn from it. Grit your teeth. Go on. Inside every failure is the information you need to succeed. So look at your failures. Figure out what went wrong and try again. And that's what I'm going to do. So if anybody has any information about grants I might be eligible for in the Seattle area or with respect to weaving, please do send me the information. I will apply. In the meantime, I would like to thank my husband, Eric S. Nyland, for underwriting this show. Feel free to go to Amazon.com and check out his books. He's a wonderful man, great husband, great writer. Here's hoping this podcast finds you healthy, happy, and well. And now it's time to get warped, because everyone knows you have to be warped to weave. music for this episode of Weavecast was provided by the PodSafe Music Network. Today we used Kicked in Heaven by AMB26 and Closer to Real by Dusty Hughes. I would like to thank the generous artists who share their work via the PodSafe Music Network.